and the two who joined Big Saul were among the most loathsome of the group, for their bodies were falling away. But they thought, "We have been thrown away by Hawaii. No one cares, and we shall soon be dead." So they dragged Kinau behind the wall and started, with their fragmentary hands, to tear away her clothes. "Please, please," she begged. But nothing could be done to interrupt the three hungry men. And when she was naked, they admired her, and pinched her body, and explored it, and laughed. And then, in turn, two held her down while the other mounted her, and in time she fainted. For 5 days, Big Saul and his cronies kept her to themselves, after which any others who thought themselves strong enough to force their way into the group were free to join. And when they saw the naked Kinau as yet unblemished, they were hungry with old memories of the days when they were whole men, and they cared nothing about what they did. Occasionally, Big Saul left the girl to make decisions as to how the lepers should dispose themselves, and he was adamant that the Chinese must stay apart. So Nyuk Tsin and her husband were forced to live at the outer edge of the community of 600 dying men and women. For the first 6 days, they slept on bare earth, and they found an abandoned wall against which they built a rough lean-to, using shrubs and leaves, for there was no lumber of any kind. For their bed, they had only raw earth, and when rain came, it crept under them so that Meng Kai, already shivering with ague, came close to dying of pneumonia. Then Nyuk Tsin, using her bare hands, for there were no implements, scraped together a platform of earth and covered it with twigs and leaves, and this made a bed into which the water could not creep unless the rainfall was unusually heavy. The two outlawed Chinese were forbidden access to the food barrels until all others had partaken, and even then Big Saul decreed that they live on half rations, and if it had not been for Nyuk Tsin's resourcefulness, they would have starved. On the reef she found small edible snails, and in one of the deserted valleys she discovered dry land taro that had gone wild. With twigs she collected from the cliffs, she built a small underground oven in which she baked the taro, so that life apart from the others had minor compensations. Certainly, the Keys lived better than the pathetic lepers who could no longer walk. In Kalawao in 1870, there were over 60 such unspeakable persons. Their feet had fallen away, their hands were stumps, and they crawled about the settlement begging food which they themselves could neither obtain nor prepare. Horrifying echoes of humanity, they often had no faces whatever, excepting eyes and voices with which to haunt the memories of those who came upon them. There was no medicine for them, no bed, no care of any kind. They crawled along the beach of Kalawao, and in God's due time they died. Usually they did not even find a grave, but were left aside until their bones were cleaned and could be laid in a shallow ditch. Sometimes the authorities in Honolulu forgot to send the Kilauea with replenishments of food, and then the settlement degenerated into absolute terror. Big Saul and his cronies commandeered whatever supplies remained and protected their rights with violence. The death rate soared, 4 or 5 cases each day, and a legless woman might lie in the path all day screaming for food or water, and no one would listen to her, hoping that in the cold night she would die. And usually she did, and her tormented body might lie there just as she had left it, for a day or even 3, until Big Saul commanded someone to remove it. There was no law in Kalawao, and there was almost no humanity. What made the situation doubly terrible was that regularly the ugly little ferryboat Kilauea appeared offshore with an additional cargo of lepers, and when they were thrown ashore with nothing, Big Saul would move among them, telling them the ultimate terrifying truth. Here there is no law. After 6 weeks of keeping the beautiful young wife Kinau a prisoner, during which time more than 18 men enjoyed her unmarked body, she was turned loose for whoever wanted her. She was allowed one flimsy dress, but the way in which she wore it proved that she had, by God's grace, lost her mind. She could remember nothing of what had happened to her, and she walked in a daze, unable to focus on the present. So that for a space of 3 or 4 months, whatever man wanted her simply grabbed her and took her to where he slept on the cold earth and played with her for as long as he wished. Then he shoved her along, and she moved like a ghost, her dress askew and no flowers in her matted hair, until some other man wanted her, and then she was his. The women of Kalawao felt sorry for her, but each had her own problem, so that no one tended the poor, crazy girl. In the fourth month, in February of 1871, that is, the virulent leprosy that abided in Kinau broke loose, and within the space of a few weeks she became a horribly riddled thing. A walking corpse with thick, bloated face, shivering lips about to fall away, and sickening illness in her breasts. Now men left her alone, but in her dementia she took off her flimsy dress and exposed the sores of her body. She walked slowly from Big Saul to his first lieutenant, and then on to his second, whimpering, "Now I should like to lie with you again." She became such a sore on the community that men could not stand seeing her approach, her body falling apart. And finally Big Saul said, "Somebody ought to knock that one on the head." So on a dark night somebody did, and she lay dead in the path for 2 days before she was finally dragged away for burial. Of course, no woman was safe on Kalawao, for Big Saul and his men were free to take whom they liked, and those who arrived on the beach with no men to protect them suffered grievously, for they were usually women not far advanced in the disease. And to be raped repeatedly by men with no faces or with hands eroded to stumps was unbearable. But there was no escape, and Kalawao was filled with women who fell into a kind of stupor, crying to themselves, "Why has God punished me?" It must not be assumed that women were blameless for the degeneration that overtook Kalawao, for there were many presentable women who felt, "I have been abandoned by society. There is no law here, and no one cares what I do." Such women helped the men brew a raw and savage liquor from roots of the tea plant, or muddy beer from stewed sweet potatoes. And for weeks at a time, whole sections of the leper population stayed madly drunk, coursing loudly through the settlement, brawling, screaming indecencies at the general population, and winding up in some public place naked and lustful, there to indulge themselves with one another to the applause of cheering witnesses. Those who inflamed these orgies and who seemed to enjoy them most were women. And it was not uncommon in those days when no priests or ministers or government officials were present to protect order, to see a half-naked woman, at the end of a 9-day drunk, stagger into a public place and cry, "I can have intercourse with any 4 men here, and when I'm through with them, they'll be half dead." And volunteers would leap at the offer, and there would be a wild, insane testing to see if she could make good her challenge. And when she was finished, she would fall asleep in a drunken, exhausted stupor right on the ground where she lay, and the night rains would come, and no one would cover her, and after a few years she would die, not of leprosy, but of tuberculosis. If anyone in those years had wished to see humanity at its positive lowest, humanity wallowing in filth of its own creation, he would have had to visit Kalawao, for not only was the peninsula cursed by leprosy, it was also scarred by human stupidity. The peninsula had 2 sides, an eastern, where cold winds blew and rain fell incessantly, and a western, where the climate was both warm and congenial. But the leper colony had been started on the inclement eastern shore, and there the government insisted that it be kept, while the kindly western shore remained unpopulated. The eastern location, being close to the towering cliffs, received its first sunlight late in the day and lost it early in the afternoon. But on the western slope, there was adequate sun. Most ridiculous of all, even though the cliffs threw down 100 waterfalls, none had been channeled into the leper settlement. At first, a little had been brought down by an inadequate tied-together pipe, but it had long since broken, so that all water had to be lugged by hand several miles, and often dying people with no kokuas to help them would spend their last 4 or 5 days pleading helplessly for a drink which they were never given. For 6 indifferent years, no official in Honolulu found time to concern himself with such problems or allocate even miserly sums to their solution. In ancient times, it had been said, out of sight, out of mind. And rarely in human history had this calloused apothegm been more concisely illustrated than at the Kalawao Lazaretto. The government had decreed, the lepers shall be banished, as if saying the words and imprisoning the leprous bodies somehow solved the problem. It would not be fair, however, to say that during these appalling first years no one cared. Brave Christian ministers from other islands sometimes visited Kalawao to solemnize marriages of dying people who did not wish to live their last days in sin. Catholic priests and Mormon disciples occasionally made the rough crossing to the Lazaretto, and their arrivals were remembered long after they had left. Dr. Whipple had come at the age of 70 to see what the settlement needed, and he reported everything. At one point, a group of religious lepers had actually started a church, and leafing through their treasured Bible had come upon that glowing passage of hope in which the Apostle John reported, "And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, Neither hath this man sin nor his parents. He spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay, and said unto him, Go, wash in the pool of Siloam. He washed and came seeing." The lepers called their church. It had no building, for Honolulu could spare no lumber. Siloama, and it kept their hope alive, for every leper was convinced that somewhere in the world there must be a pool of Siloam, or a medicine, or an unguent that would cure him. Because Nyuktsin was pregnant, she escaped the attentions of Big Saul and his ruthless gang. But as her birth time approached, she forgot him and suffered apprehensions of a different nature. For one thing, the lack of water troubled her, and she wondered what her husband would do when the baby came, for he had only one small receptacle for water and no fire at which to heat it. Munkai promised, "I'll ask some of the Hawaiian women to help, and they'll have buckets." But Big Saul would permit no one to go near the Chinese shed. And on the final day, Nyuktsin gave birth to her 5th son, under conditions that would not have been permitted had she been an animal. No water, no clean clothes waiting for the child, no food to speed the mother's milk, no bed for the infant except the cold ground. There was not even clean straw upon which the mother could lie. Nevertheless, she produced a ruddy-faced, slant-eyed little fellow, and then her great worries began. No one knew at that time how the contagion of leprosy operated, for it was a fact that many kokuas like Nyuktsin lived in the Lazaretto for years in the most intimate contact with lepers without ever acquiring the maipaki, so mere contact could not be the explanation. But she had learned that if children below the age of 8 stayed very long in contact with leprosy, they were sure to catch it. So she nursed her infant as best she could, and prayed for the arrival of the next Kilauea. While she waited, she did many things to make her son prematurely strong. She exposed him daily to the winds so that he would know them. She fed him constantly to build health. She slapped him vigorously to make him resist shock. But at night, she cuddled him warmly between her shallow breasts, and she loved him desperately. When the Kilauea finally arrived, she was filled with excitement and a determination to act carefully. Therefore, as soon as the 1st longboat arrived with its cargo of lepers, she went down to the landing and called to one of the rowers, "My baby is to go back on your ship," and she made as if to enter the longboat with the child. But the sailors of the Kilauea were perilously afraid that some day the Kalawao lepers might try to capture their ship and escape, and Yuk-tsin's motion seemed as if it could be the beginning of such an attempt, so the sailor swiftly knocked her down with an oar and shouted to his mates, "Push off! Push off!" But when they were safely at sea, Yuk-tsin, protecting her son, struggled back to her feet and called again, "It is my baby who is to go back on your ship." "We'll ask the captain," shouted back one of the sailors. And on the next trip in, he yelled, "Where's the pake with the baby?" And Yuk-tsin almost stumbled, she ran so fast to give her reply. But she was near tears when the sailor shoved the baby back and said, "Captain wants to know where the baby goes." Yuk-tsin eagerly explained, "He goes to Dr. Whipple in the big house." "Doc Whipple died last month," the sailor growled, and prepared to shove off. Yuk-tsin was staggered by this news and sought frantically for an alternative. "Give the baby to Kimo and Apikela, the myla gatherers," she cried eagerly. "Where in hell's that?" the sailor asked, and they rowed back to the ship. On the next trip, they advised the agonized Chinese woman that they thought they'd better not take the child because they had no idea what to do with it when they got to Honolulu, and since there was no wet nurse aboard on this trip, the baby would have no food for a full day. Yuk-tsin tried to explain that the captain could give the child to any Chinese, and as for food, she had made little bags filled with poi which he could suck. But the longboat pulled away, and in complete panic, Yuk-tsin saw the Kilauea prepared to steam off. So without knowing what she was attempting, she walked out into the surf with her child in her arms, and she started vainly to attempt swimming to the departing ship. But as soon as she was in the water, the fine Hawaiian swimmer who had shared the leper cage with Mun Kai saw her plight and leaped in beside her, grasped the infant in his left arm, and started swimming strongly toward the ship. The captain saw him coming and halted the engine for a moment until the powerful brown man caught hold of a rope and with a heave pulled himself up and threw the child into the arms of a waiting sailor. Then, with the same movement, he dropped back into the sea and started a long, easy stroke which carried him back to the leper settlement. The Kilauea sounded its whistle. The white goats sprang higher up the cliff sides, and Yuk-tsin stood with her husband Mun Kai as their son Australia vanished. But all who stood with them watching the ship go knew that, no matter where the child was taken or to whom, it was better off than it would have been on Kalawao. In the seventh month of their stay on Kalawao, the depredations of Big Sol and his cronies finally threatened the Chinese because Yuk-tsin was recovered from her pregnancy. Therefore, the men began to study her, saying among themselves, "A man could have a good time with her, and she's not diseased at all." Accordingly, three of them swooped down one night on the grassy shack and grabbed for Yuk-tsin. But she and her husband had long ago prepared themselves for this event, and the invaders were met by two fighting Chinese armed with sharply pointed sticks. It was a bitter, silent fight, with doomed Mun Kai rising from his bed of leaves to battle desperately with Big Sol, while Yuk-tsin, with pointed sticks in her hands, slashed and jabbed at the other two. Once she was caught around the waist by arms that had only fragmentary hands, and she could smell the foul breath of a leper dragging her to him. But she jabbed backward with her sticks, and he screamed with pain and released her. Now there were two Chinese against two invaders, and like a jungle animal she instinctively ignored her own assailant and sprang for the jugular of Big Sol, the leader. And with great force she jabbed her remaining stick at the side of his head, and it must have struck either his ear and gone in there, or the soft part of his temple, for it pressed inward, long and sharp and pleasingly. At the same time Mun Kai ripped upward with his sharp stick, and Big Sol gasped. Clutching his two vital wounds, he staggered away into the night and began shouting, "The Pakes have killed me!" This diverted his unwounded helper, who ran to assist his chief, while the third man stumbled in the darkness with 3 inches of stick protruding from his left eye. "The Pakes have killed me!" Big Sol bellowed, and he awakened all the community. so that by the time he actually did stagger mortally wounded into a circle of torches, all who could walk were present to witness his gasping, clutching death. Silently, they withdrew from the ugly corpse. There were few who had not suffered at the hands of Big Saul, and now that they saw his leprosy-riddled body in the dust, they were content to leave him. His blinded crony slipped away into the night, and silence fell upon the lepers of Kalawao. For the two Chinese, it was a dreadful night. They could not know that the community at large approved the death of Big Saul and the blinding of his bully companion. They could not know, huddling alone together in the dark night, that no one in Kalawao was ignorant of how the huge man had met his death. He went to rape the Pake girl, and her husband killed him. Good for the Pake. Toward morning, it began to rain, and the mournful drops falling upon the leafy roof and creeping across the floor, first in tiny traces and finally in a small river, added to the misery. And Yuk Tsin whispered to her shivering companion, "We did the right thing, Wu Chao's father. The others should have done this years ago." "Have we any sticks left?" Mun Kai asked. "I lost both of mine," his wife confessed. "I have one left, and there's another hidden under the leaves. I think that when they come to seize us in the morning, we should fight until we are dead." "I think so too," Nyok Tsin replied. And she went to the corner of the miserable hut, and from the muddy earth picked up the other weapon. In the lonely silence, not knowing when Big Saul's men would reattack, they waited. And Yuk Tsin said, "I am glad, Wu Chao's father, that I came with you. I am humbly honored that tonight you fought to help me." "I have forgotten that you are a Hakka," he replied. The rain increased, and for a moment the couple thought they heard the noise of lepers assembling to attack them, but it was only the rustle of water down the sides of the cliff. So Nyuk Tsin asked, "Do you forgive me for my ungainly feet?" And her husband replied, "I don't see them anymore." They huddled together in the cold, dark night, and Mun Kai said, "You must promise, Wu Chao's auntie, that if you ever escape from here, you will be sure to send my real wife in China as much money as possible." "I promise," Nyuk Tsin replied. "And you must enter my boys' names in the village hall." "I will do so." "And when you send the news to the hall, you don't have to mention that you are a Hakka. It would embarrass my wife." "I will not say anything to the letter writer," Nyuk Tsin promised. "And you must promise to bury me on the side of a hill." "I shall, just as if we were in China." "And you must promise to bring my sons to honor my grave." "I shall do so," Nyuk Tsin agreed. And Mun Kai said, "When dawn comes, we will die, Wu Chao's auntie, and the promises you have made mean nothing. But I feel better." Through the long rainy night they waited, and when the gray, cold dawn arrived, Mun Kai the gambler said, "Let's wait for them no longer. Let's march out to meet them." And the two Chinese left the foul grass lean-to, each with a jagged, sharp piece of wood in his right hand. It was with horror that they saw, slumped in the rain-filled path, the dead body of Big Saul, for they knew that this doomed them to retaliation from the others of the gang. But as they cautiously approached the village, their sticks ready for the final fight, they saw with amazement that the Hawaiian lepers did not draw back in enmity, but moved forward in conciliation. And slowly the deadly sticks were lowered, and at last the two Chinese stood surrounded by dying men and women who said, "You did a good thing." And one woman who had been sadly abused by Big Saul and his gang, but who had stubbornly refused to go insane, said quietly,